Lifting the damp cloth that lay across her eyes, carefully so she did not catch the bracelet and rings Angreal in her hair, she wore that and her jeweled Turangreal every waking moment now. Nynaeve sat up on the edge of her bed. With men needing healing from dreadful wounds, some missing a hand or an arm, it had seemed petty to ask healing for a headache, but the willow bark seemed to have worked as well. Only more slowly. One of her rings, set with a pale green stone that now appeared to glow with a faint internal light, seemed to vibrate continually on her finger, though it did not really move. The pattern of vibrations was mixed, a reaction to Sidar and Sidene being channeled outside. For that matter, someone could have been channeling inside. Catswain was sure it should be able to indicate direction, but she could not say how. Ha! For Catswain and her supposed superior knowledge. She wished she could say that to the woman's face. It was not that Catswain intimidated her. Certainly not. She stood above Catswain. Just that she wanted to maintain some degree of harmony. That was the reason she held her tongue around the woman. The rooms she shared with Lan were spacious but also drafty, with no casement fitting its window properly, and over the generations the house had settled enough that the doors had been trimmed so they could close all the way, making more gaps to let every breeze whistle through. The fire on the stone hearth danced as though it were outdoors, crackling and spitting sparks. The carpet, so faded she could no longer really make out the pattern, had more holes burned in it than she could count. The bed with its heavy bedposts and worn canopy was large and sturdy, but the mattress was lumpy, the pillows held more feathers that poked through than they did down, and the blankets seemed almost more darns than original material. But Lan shared the rooms, and that made all the difference. That made them a palace. He stood at one of the windows where he had been since the attack began, staring down now at the work going on outside. Or perhaps studying the slaughter yard the manor house grounds had become. He was so still he might have been a statue, a tall man in a well-fitting dark green coat, his shoulders broad enough to make his waist appear slender, with the leather cord of his hadori holding back his shoulder-length hair, black, tinged with white at the temples. A hard-faced man, yet beautiful. In her eyes he was, let anyone else say what they would. Only they had best not say it in her hearing. Even Catswain. A ring bearing a flawless sapphire was cold on her right hand. It seemed more likely he was feeling anger than hostility. That ring did have a flaw in her estimation. It was all very well to know someone nearby was feeling angry or hostile, but that did not mean the emotion was directed at you. "It's time for me to go back outside and lend a hand again," she said as she stood. "Not yet," he told her without turning from the window. Ring or no ring, his deep voice was calm and quite firm. "Moiraine used to say a headache was sign she'd been channeling too much. That's dangerous." Her hand strayed toward her braid before she could snatch it down again, as if he knew more about channeling than she. Well, in some ways he did. 20 years as Moiraine's warder had taught him as much as a man could know of Sidar. "My headache is completely gone. I'm perfectly all right now."
"Don't be petulant, my love. There are only a few hours till twilight. Plenty of work will be left tomorrow."
His left hand tightened on the hilt of his sword, relaxed, tightened. Only that hand moved. Her lips compressed. "Petulant?" She smoothed her skirt furiously. She was not petulant. He seldom invoked his right to command in private. Curse those sea folk for ever thinking of such a thing. But when he did, the man was unbending. Of course she could go anyway. He would not try to stop her physically. She was certain of that. Fairly certain. Only she did not intend to violate her marriage vows in the slightest way, even if she did want to kick her beloved husband's shins. Kicking her skirts instead, she went to stand beside him at the window and slip her arm through his. His arm was rock hard, though. His muscles were hard, wonderfully so, but this was the hardness of tension as though he were straining to lift a great weight. How she wished she had his bond, to give her hints of what was troubling him, when she laid hands on Mirelle. No, best not to think of that hussy. Greens. They simply could not be trusted with men. Outside, not far from the house, she could see a pair of those black-coated Ashaman and the sisters bonded to them. She had avoided that whole lot as much as possible. The Ashaman for obvious reasons, the sisters because they supported Elida. Yet you could not spend time in the same house with people, even a house as large and rambling as Algarin's, and avoid coming to recognize them. Arul Malavin was a Kyrianan who seemed even wider than he actually was because he stood barely chest-high to Lan. Donalo Sandomir, a Tyran, with a garnet in his left ear, and his gray-streaked beard trimmed to a point and oiled, although she doubted very much that his creased, leathery face belonged to a noble. Malavin had bonded Isling Noon, a fierce-eyed green who peppered her speech with borderland oaths that sometimes made Lan wince. Nynaeve wished she understood them, but he refused to explain. Sandomir's captive was Ayako Norsoni, a diminutive white with wavy, waist-length black hair who was nearly as brown-skinned as a Damani. She seemed shy, a rarity among Aes Sedai. Both women wore their fringed shawls. The captives almost always did, perhaps as gestures of defiance. But then they seemed to get on strangely well with the men. Often Nynaeve had seen them chatting companionably, hardly the behavior of defiant prisoners. And she suspected that Loghain and Gabrella were not the only pair sharing a bed outside wedlock. It was disgraceful! Suddenly fires bloomed below, six enveloping dead Trollocs in front of Malavin and Isling, seven in front of Sandomir and Ayako, and she squinted against the blinding glare. It was like trying to look at 13 noonday suns blazing in a cloudless sky. They were linked. She could tell from the way the flows of Sidar moved, stiffly, as though they were being forced into place rather than guided. Or rather, the men were trying to force them. That never worked with the female half of the power. It was pure fire, and the blazes were ferocious, fiercer than she would have expected from fire alone. But of course they would be using Sidene as well, and who could say what they were adding from that murderous chaos? The little she could recall of being linked with Rand left her with no desire ever again to go near that. In just a few minutes the fires vanished, leaving only low heaps of grayish ash lying on seared earth that looked hard and cracked. That could not do the soil much good. "You can't find this very entertaining, Lan. What are you thinking?"
"Idle thoughts," he said, his arm hard as stone beneath her hand. New fires flared outside.
"Share them with me." She managed to put a hint of question in that. He seemed amused by the nature of their vows, yet he absolutely refused to follow the smallest instruction when they were alone. Requests he granted instantly, well, most of the time, but the man would quietly leave his boots muddy till the mud flaked off if she told him not to track in mud.
"Unpleasant thoughts, but if you wish. The Murdral and Trollocs make me think of Tarmon Gaiden."
"Unpleasant thoughts indeed." Still staring out the window, he nodded. There was no expression on his face. Lan could teach Aes Sedai about hiding emotions, but a touch of heat entered his voice.
"It's coming soon, Nynaeve. Yet Althor seems to think he has forever to dance with the Seanchan. Shadowspawn could be moving down through the Blight while we stand here, down through..." His mouth snapped shut.
"Down through Malkyr," he'd almost said. "Dead Malkyr, the murdered land of his birth." She was sure of it. He went on as if he had not paused.
"They could strike at Shinar, at the whole Borderlands, next week or tomorrow. And Althor sits weaving his Seanchan schemes. He should send someone to convince King Isar and the others to return to their duty along the Blight. He should be marshalling all the force he can gather and taking it to the Blight. The last battle will be there, and at Shael Ghul. The war is there."
Sadness welled up in her, yet she managed to keep it out of her voice. "You have to go back," she said quietly. At last he turned his head, frowning down at her. His clear blue eyes were so cold. They held less of death than they had, of that she was certain, but they were still so cold.
"My place is with you, heart of my heart, ever and always."
She gathered all of her courage and held on to it hard, so hard that she ached. She wanted to speak fast, to get the words out before courage failed, but she forced herself to a steady tone and an even pace. A borderland saying I heard from you once. Death is lighter than a feather, duty heavier than a mountain. My duty lies here, making sure Olivia doesn't kill Rand. But I will take you to the borderlands. Your duty lies there. You want to go to Shinar? You mentioned King Isar and Shinar, and it is close to Malkyr. He looked down at her for a long time, but at last he exhaled softly and the tension left his arm.
Are you sure, Nynaeve? If you are, then yes, Shinar. In the Trolloc Wars, the Shadow used Tarwyn's Gap to move large numbers of Trollocs, just as it did a few years back when we sought the Eye of the World. But only if you are completely sure.
No, she was not sure. She wanted to cry, to scream at him that he was a fool, that his place was with her, not dying alone in a futile private war with the Shadow. Only she could not say any of that. Bond or no bond, she knew he was torn inside, torn between his love of her and his duty, torn and bleeding as surely as if he had been stabbed with a sword. She could not add to his wounds. She could try to make sure he survived, though. "Would I make the offer if I wasn't sure?" she said dryly, surprised at how calm she sounded. "I won't like sending you away, but you have your duty, and I have mine." Wrapping his arms around her, he hugged her to his chest, gently at first, then harder, until she thought he might squeeze all the air from her lungs. She did not care. She hugged him just as fiercely, and had to pry her hands from his broad back when she was done at last. Light she wanted to weep, and knew she must not. As he began packing his saddlebags, she hurriedly changed into a riding dress of yellow-slashed green silk and stout leather shoes, then slipped from the room before he was done. Algarin's library was large, a square, high-ceilinged room, lined with shelves. Half a dozen cushioned chairs stood scattered around the floor, and a long table and a tall map rack completed the furnishings. The stone hearth was cold, and the iron stand lamps unlit, but she channeled briefly to light three of them. A hasty search found the maps she needed in the rack's diamond-shaped compartments. They were as old as most of the books, yet the land did not change greatly in 200 or 300 years. When she returned to their rooms, Lan was in the sitting room, saddlebags on his shoulder, Warder's color-shifting cloak hanging down his back. His face was still, a stone mask. She took only time to get her own cloak, blue silk lined with velvet, and they walked in silence, her right hand resting lightly on his left wrist, out to the dimly lit stable where their horses were kept. The air there smelled of hay and horses and horse dung, as it always did in stables. A lean, balding groom with a nose that had been broken more than once sighed when Lan told him they wanted Landarb and Lover's Knot saddled. A grey-haired woman began work on Nynaeve's stout brown mare, while three of the aging men made a job of getting Lan's tall black stallion bridled and out of his stall. "I want a promise from you," Nynaeve said quietly as they waited. Mandarb danced in circles so that the plump fellow trying to lift the saddle onto the stallion's back had to run trying to catch up. "An oath. I mean it, Lan Mandragoran. We aren't alone any longer."
"What do you want my oath on?" he asked warily. The balding groom called for two more men to help.
"That you'll ride to Falmoran before you enter the Blight, and that if anyone wants to ride with you, you'll let him."
His smile was small and sad. "I've always refused to lead men into the Blight, Nynaeve. There were times men rode with me, but I would not—"
"If men have ridden with you before," she cut in, "men can ride with you again. Your oath on it, or I vow I'll let you ride the whole long way to Shinar."
The woman was fastening the cinches on Lover's Knot's saddle, but the three men were still struggling to get Mandarb's saddle on his back, to keep him from shaking off the saddle blanket. "How far south in Shinar do you mean to leave me?" he asked.
When she said nothing, he nodded.
"Very well, Nynaeve, if that's what you want. I swear it under the light and by my hope of rebirth and salvation."
It was very hard not to sigh with relief. She had managed it, and without lying. She was trying to do as Egwene wanted and behave as though she had already taken the three oaths on the oath rod, but it was very hard dealing with a husband if you could not lie even when it was absolutely necessary. "Kiss me," she told him, adding hastily, "That wasn't an order. I just want to kiss my husband." A goodbye kiss. There would be no time for one later. "In front of everyone," he said, laughing. "You've always been so shy about that." The woman was nearly done with Lover's Knot, and one of the grooms was holding Mandarb as steady as he could, while the other two hurriedly buckled the cinches. "They're too busy to see anything. Kiss me, or I'll think you're the one who's..." His lips on hers shut off words. Her toes curled. Sometime later she was leaning on his broad chest to catch her breath while he stroked her hair.
"Perhaps we can have one last night together in Shinar," he murmured softly. "It may be some time before we're together again, and I'll miss having my back clawed."
Her face grew hot, and she pushed away from him unsteadily. The grooms were done and staring very pointedly at the straw-covered floor, but they might well be close enough to overhear. "I think not." She was proud that she did not sound breathless. "I don't want to leave Rand alone with Olivia that long."
"He trusts her, Nynaeve. I don't understand it, but there it is, and that's all that matters."
She sniffed, as if any man knew what was good for him. Her stout mare whickered uneasily as they rode among dead trollocs to a patch of ground not far from the stable that she knew well enough to weave a gateway. Mandar, a trained warhorse, reacted not at all to the blood and the stench and the huge corpses. The black stallion seemed as calm as his rider, now that Lan was on his back. She could understand that. Lan had a very calming effect on her, too. Usually. Sometimes he had exactly the opposite effect. She wished they could have one more night together. Her face grew hot again. Dismounting, she drew on Sidar without using the Angreal and wove a gateway just tall enough for her to lead Lover's Knot through onto grassland, dotted with thickets of black-spotted beech and trees she did not recognize. The sun was a golden ball, only a little down from its peak, yet the air was decidedly cooler than in Tyr. Cold enough to make her gather her cloak, in fact. Mountains topped with snow and clouds rose to the east and north and south. As soon as Lan was through, she let the weave dissipate and immediately wove another gateway, larger, while she climbed into her saddle and settled the cloak around her again. Lan led Mandarb a few steps westward, staring. Land ended abruptly in what was obviously a cliff no more than 20 paces from him, and from there ocean stretched to the horizon.
"What is the meaning of this?" he demanded, turning back. "This isn't Shinar. It's World End in Saldaea, as far from Shinar as you can get and still be in the Borderlands."
"I told you I would take you to the Borderlands, Lan, and I have. Remember your oath, my heart, because I surely will." And with that she dug her heels in the mare's flanks and let the animal bolt through the open gateway. She heard him call her name, but she let the gateway close behind her. She would give him a chance to survive.
Only a few hours past midday, less than half a dozen tables were occupied in the large common room of the Queen's Lance. Most of the well-dressed men and women, with clerks and bodyguards standing attentively behind them, were there to buy or sell ice peppers, which grew well in the foothills on the landward side of the Bannockburn Mountains, called the Sea Wall by many in Saldaea. Wylan Aldragoran had no interest in peppers. The Sea Wall had other crops, and richer. "My final price," he said, waving a hand over the table. Every finger bore a jeweled ring. Not large stones, but fine. A man who sold gems should advertise. He traded in other things as well. Furs, rare woods for cabinet makers, finely made swords and armor, occasionally other things that afforded a good return. But gems brought in the greater part of his profit in any year. "I'll come no lower." The table was covered with a piece of black velvet, the better to show off a good portion of his stock. emeralds, fire drops, sapphires, and best of all, diamonds. Several of those were large enough to interest a ruler, and none was small. None held a flaw, either. He was known throughout the Borderlands for his flawless stones. "Accept it, or someone else will." The younger of the two dark-eyed Ilioners across him, a clean-shaven fellow named Pavel Geraneos, opened his mouth angrily, but the older, Georg Damantanis, his gray-streaked beard practically quivering, laid a fat hand on Geraneos's arm and gave him a horrified look. Aldragoran made no effort to conceal his smile, showing a little tooth. He had been only a toddler when the Trollocs swept down into Melkir, and he had no memories of that land at all. He seldom even thought of Melkir. The land was dead and gone, yet he was glad he had let his uncles give him the Hadori. At another table, Manigan was in a shouting match with a dark Tyran woman wearing a lace ruff and rather inferior garnets in her ears, the pair of them nearly drowning out the young woman playing the hammered dulcimer on the low platform beside one of the tall stone fireplaces. That lean young man had refused the Hadori, as had Goranellan, who was near Aldragoran's age. Goranellan was bargaining hard with a pair of olive-skinned Altarans, one of whom had a nice ruby in his left ear, and there was sweat on Goranellan's forehead. No one shouted at a man who wore the Hadori and a sword, as Aldragoran did, and they tried to avoid making him sweat. Such men carried a reputation for sudden, unpredictable violence. If he had seldom been forced to use the sword at his hip, it was widely known that he could and would.
"I do accept, Master Aldragoran," Damantanis said, giving his companion a sidelong glare.
Not noticing, Geraneos bared his teeth in what he probably hoped Aldragoran would take for a smile. Aldragoran let it pass. He was a merchant, after all. A reputation was a fine thing when it enhanced your bargaining power, but only a fool went looking for fights. The Ilioner's clerk, a weedy graying fellow, and also Ilioner, unlocked their iron-strapped coin box under the watchful eyes of their two bodyguards, bulky men with those odd beards that left the upper lip bare, in leather coats sewn with steel discs. Each carried a sword and stout cudgel at his belt. Aldragoran had a clerk at his own back, a hard-eyed Saldaean, who did not know one end of a sword from the other, but he never used bodyguards. Guards on his premises, to be sure, but not bodyguards. That only added its bit to his reputation. And, of course, he had no need of them. Once Damantanis had endorsed two letters of rights and passed over three leather purses fat with gold, Aldragoran counted the coins but did not bother weighing them. Some of those thick crowns from 10 different lands would be lighter than others, yet he was willing to accept the inevitable loss. The Ilioners carefully gathered up the stones, sorting them into wash-leather purses that went into the coin box. He offered them more wine, but the stout man declined politely, and they departed with the bodyguards carrying the iron-strapped box between them. How they were to protect anything burdened so was beyond him. Kayakun was far from a lawless town, but there were more footpads abroad than usual of late. More footpads, more murderers, more arsonists, more of every sort of crime. Not to mention madness of the sort a man just did not want to think on. Still, the gems were the Ilioner's concern now. Ruthen had Eldragoran's coin box open. A pair of bearers were waiting outside to carry it, but he sat staring at the letters of rights and the purses. Half again what he had expected to get. Light coins from Altara and Murundi or no light coins, at least half again. This would be his most profitable year ever. And all due to Geraneos letting his anger show. Damantanis had been afraid to bargain further after that. A wonderful thing, reputation.
"Master Aldragoran," a woman said, leaning on the table, "you were pointed out to me as a merchant with a wide correspondence by pigeon."
He noticed her jewelry first, of course, a matter of habit. The slim golden belt and long necklace were set with very good rubies, as was one of her bracelets, along with some pale green and blue stones he did not recognize and so dismissed as worthless. The golden bracelet on her left wrist, an odd affair linked to four finger rings by flat chains, and the whole, intricately engraved, held no stones, but her remaining two bracelets were set with fine sapphires and more of the green stones. Two of the rings on her right hand held those green stones, but the other two held particularly fine sapphires. Particularly fine. Then he realized she wore a fifth ring on that hand, stuck against one of the rings with a worthless stone. A golden serpent biting its own tail. His eyes jerked to her face, and he suffered his second shock. Her face, framed by the hood of her cloak, was very young, but she wore the ring, and few were foolish enough to do that without the rite. He had seen young Aes Sedai before, two or three times. No, her age did not shock him. But on her forehead she wore the kasine, the red dot of a married woman. She did not look Melchiori, she did not sound Melchiori. Many younger folk had the accents of Saldea or Kandor, Arafel or Shinar. He himself sounded of Saldea, but she did not sound a borderlander at all. Besides, he could not recall the last time he had heard of a Melchiori girl going to the White Tower. The tower had failed Melchior in need, and the Melchiori had turned their backs on the tower. Still, he stood hurriedly. With Aes Sedai, courtesy was always wise. Her dark eyes held heat. Yes, courtesy was wise.
"How may I help you, Aes Sedai? You wish me to send a message for you via my pigeons? It will be my pleasure."
It was also wise to grant Aes Sedai any favors they asked, and a pigeon was a small favor.
"A message to each merchant you correspond with. Tommen Gaiden is coming soon."
He shrugged uneasily. "That has nothing to do with me, Aes Sedai. I am a merchant." She was asking for a good many pigeons. He corresponded with merchants as far away as Shinar.
"But I will send your message."
He would, too, however many birds it required. Only stone-blind idiots failed to keep promises to Aes Sedai, besides which he wanted rid of her and her talk of the last battle.
"Do you recognize this?" she said, fishing a leather cord from the neck of her dress.
His breath caught, and he stretched out a hand, brushed a finger across the heavy gold signet ring on the cord. Across the crane in flight. How had she come by this? Under the light, how?
"I recognize it,"
he told her, his voice suddenly hoarse.
"My name is Nynaeve d'Almira Mandragoran. The message I want sent is this. My husband rides from World's End toward Tarwin's Gap, toward Tarmen Gaiden. Will he ride alone?"
He trembled. He did not know whether he was laughing or crying, perhaps both. She was his wife?
"I will send your message, my lady, but it has nothing to do with me. I am a merchant. Melchior is dead. Dead, I tell you."
The heat in her eyes seemed to intensify, and she gripped her long, thick braid with one hand.
"Lan told me once that Melchior lives so long as one man wears the Hadorian pledge that he will fight the shadow, so long as one woman wears the Kaisinan pledge that she will send her sons to fight the shadow. I wear the Kaisine, Master Aldragoran. My husband wears the Hadori. So do you. Will Lan Mandragoran ride to the last battle alone?"
He was laughing, shaking with it, and yet he could feel tears rolling down his cheeks. It was madness, complete madness, but he could not help himself.
"He will not, my lady. I cannot stand surety for anyone else, but I swear to you under the light and by my hope of rebirth and salvation, he will not ride alone."
For a moment she studied his face, then nodded once firmly and turned away. He flung out a hand after her.
"May I offer you wine, my lady? My wife will want to meet you."
Alida was Saldean,
but she definitely would want to meet the wife of the uncrowned king.
Thank you, Master Aldregaran, but I have several more towns to visit today, and I must be back in Tyr tonight.
He blinked at her back as she glided toward the door, gathering her cloak. She had several more towns to visit today, and she had to be back in Tyr tonight? Truly, Aes Sedai were capable of marvels.
Silence hung in the common room. They had not been keeping their voices low, and even the girl with the dulcimer had ceased playing her hammers. Everyone was staring at him. Most of the outlanders had their mouths hanging open.
"Well, Manigan, Gorenellen," he demanded, "do you still remember who you are? Do you remember your blood? Who rides with me for Tarwin's Gap?"
For a moment he thought neither man would speak. But then Gorenellen was on his feet, tears glistening his eyes.
"The Golden Crane flies for Tarmangaiden," he said softly. "The Golden Crane flies for Tarmangaiden!" Manigan shouted, leaping up so fast he overturned his chair.
Laughing, Aldragoran joined them, all three shouting at the top of their lungs.
"The Golden Crane flies for Tarmangaiden!"
Chapter 21. Within the Stone. The mud of the outer city gave way to paved streets at the walls of Tyr, where the first thing Rant noticed was the absence of guards. Despite the lofty stone ramparts with their towers, the city was less defended than Steading Shangtai, where he and every other human had been gently but firmly refused entrance at first light. Here, the archers' balconies on the towers were empty. The iron-strapped door of the squat gray guardhouse just inside the broad gates stood wide open, and a hard-faced woman in rough woolens, her sleeves shoved up her thin arms, sat there at a wooden tub, scrubbing clothes with a washboard. She appeared to have taken up residence. Two small, grubby children, sucking their thumbs, stared wide-eyed past her at him and his companions. At their horses, at least. Taidai Shah was a sight to stare at. A sleek black stallion with a massive chest, a horse that drew attention, yet he had chosen to ride the animal anyway. If the Forsaken could find him as easily as they had at Elgaran's manor house, there was little point to hiding, or at least to putting too much effort into it. He wore black riding gloves to conceal the dragon's heads on his hands and the heron's branded into his palms. His coat was dark gray wool, without a stitch of embroidery, the stallion's saddlecloth simple, and his sword's hilt and scabbard had been covered in unworked boar hide ever since it came into his possession, nothing to pull a second glance. Cadswain, in unadorned gray wool, wore the hood of her dark green cloak well up to shield her Aes Sedai face, but Min, Nynaeve, and Olivia had no need for hiding. Though Min's flower-embroidered red coat and snug breeches might attract a little notice, not to mention her heeled red boots. He had seen women in Kyrian wearing clothes like that, copying her. Yet it seemed unlikely that her fashion had spread to Tyr, where modesty held sway. In public, at least. Nynaeve was wearing yellow-slashed blue silk and all of her jewelry, just partly concealed by her blue cloak, but Tyr would be full of silks. She had wanted to wear her shawl. That was in her saddlebags, though. A little effort only. The second thing he noticed was the sound, a rhythmic, racketing clatter, accompanied periodically by a piercing whistle. Faint at first, it seemed to be coming closer rapidly. Despite the early hour, the streets he could see from the gates were crowded. Half the people inside appeared to be sea folk, the men bare-chested, the women in bright linen blouses, all wearing long slashes more colorful than those worn by Tyran commoners. Every head appeared to be turned toward that sound. Children darted through the throng, dodging carts, most often pulled by oxen with wide horns, racing toward the noise. Several well-dressed men and women had dismounted from their sedan chairs and stood with their bearers to watch. A fork-bearded merchant with silver chains across the chest of his coat was half out of the window of a red-lacquered coach, shouting at his driver to manage the nervously dancing team while he strained for a better view.
White-winged pigeons, startled from pointed slate rooftops by a particularly sharp whistle, suddenly wheeled into the air, and two large flocks crashed into one another, pelting the folk below with stunned birds. Every single bird fell. A few people actually stopped staring toward the approaching noise and gaped at the sky. A surprising number snatched up fallen birds and wrung their necks, though, and not just barefoot people in worn woolens. A woman in silk and lace, standing beside one of the sedan chairs, quickly gathered half a dozen before gazing toward the noise, with the birds dangling from her hands by their feet. Olivia made a startled sound.
"Is that ill luck or good?" she drawled. "It must be ill, unless pigeons here are different."
Nynaeve gave her a sour look, but said nothing. She had been very quiet since Lan vanished the day before, a subject on which she was doubly silent.
"Some of those people are going to die of hunger," Min said sadly.
The bond quivered with sorrow.
"Every last one I can see something about."
"How can I hide?"
Luz Theron laughed.
"I am Tavirin."
"You're dead," Rand thought at him sharply. People in front of him were going to starve, and he laughed. There was nothing to be done, of course, not when Min spoke, but laughing was another matter.
"I am Tavirin. Me."
What else was happening in Tyr because of his presence? His being Tavirin did not always have any effect at all, but when it did, the result could blanket an entire city. Best to get on with what he had come for before the wrong people figured out what things like pigeons flying into one another meant. If the Forsaken were sending armies of Trollocs and Murdral after him, it was likely that Dark Friends would take any opportunity to put an arrow through his ribs. Making little effort to hide was not the same as making no effort.
"You might as well have brought the Banner of Light and an honor guard of thousands instead of six,"
Cadswain murmured dryly, eyeing the maidens who were trying to pretend they had nothing to do with Rand's party while standing in a wide circle around it, Shufa covering their heads and veils hanging down their chests. Two were Shido, fierce-eyed whenever they looked at him. The maidens' spears were all on their backs, stuck through the harness of their bowcases, but only because Rand had offered to leave them behind and take someone else otherwise. Nandera had insisted on at least a few maidens, staring at him with eyes as hard as emeralds. He had never considered refusing. The only child of a maiden any maiden had ever known, he had obligations to meet. He gathered Tidaishar's reins, and abruptly a large wagon full of machinery came into sight, clanking and hissing, wide iron-studded wheels striking sparks from the gray paving stones as it moved along the street as fast as a man could trot. The machinery seemed to sweat steam. A heavy wooden shaft swung up and down, pushing another vertical shaft, and gray wood smoke drifted from a metal chimney. But there was no sign of a horse, just an odd sort of tiller in the front to turn the wheels. One of the three men standing in the wagon pulled a long cord, and steam rushed in a shrill whistle out of a tube atop a huge iron cylinder. If the onlookers stared in awe and maybe covered their ears, the fork-bearded merchant's team was in no such mood. Whinnying wildly, they bolted, scattering people as they ran and nearly pitching the man out on his head. Curses pursued them, and several braying mules that galloped off with their drivers in bouncing carts, sawing at the reins. Even a few oxen began to lumber along more quickly. Min's astonishment filled the bond. Controlling the black with his knees, trained as warhorse, Tidaishar responded immediately, though he still snorted. Rand stared in amazement, too. It seemed Master Pole actually had made his steam wagon work.
"But how did you get the thing to Tyr?" he asked the air.
The last he had seen, it had been at the Academy of Kyrian, and seizing up every few paces.
"It's called a steam horse, my lord,"
a barefoot, dirty-faced urchin in a ragged shirt said, bouncing on the pavement. Even the sash holding up his baggy breeches seemed as much holes as cloth.
"I've seen it 9 times. Come here's only seen it 7. "A steam wagon, Donnie," his equally ragged companion put in. "A steam wagon."
Neither of them could have been more than 10, and they were gaunt rather than skinny. Their muddy feet, torn shirts, and holed breeches meant they came from outside the walls, where the poorest folk lived. Rand had changed a number of laws in Tyr, especially those that weighed down heavily on the poor, but he had been unable to change everything. He had not even known how to begin. Luce Theron began to maunder on about taxes and money-creating jobs, but he might as well have been spilling out words at random for all the sense he made. Rand muted the voice to a buzz, a fly on the other side of a room.
"Four of them hitched together, one behind the other, pulled 100 wagons all the way from Kyrian," Donnie went on, ignoring the other boy. "They covered near 100 miles every day, my lord. 100 miles!"
Calm sighed heavily.
"There were 6 of them, Donnie, and they only pulled 50 wagons, but they covered more than 100 miles every day. 120 some days, I heard, and it was one of the steam men said it."
Donnie turned to scowl at him, the pair of them balling up fists.
"Either way, it's a remarkable achievement," Rand told them quickly, before they could begin trading blows. "Here."
Dipping into his coat pocket, he pulled out 2 coins and tossed 1 toward each boy without looking to see what they were. Gold glittered in the air before the boys eagerly snatched the coins. Exchanging startled glances, they went running out through the gates as fast as they could go, no doubt fearful he would demand the coins back. Their families could live for months on that much gold. Min gazed after them with an expression of misery that the bond echoed even after she shook her head and smoothed her face. What had she seen? Death, probably. Rand felt anger, but no sorrow. How many tens of thousands would die before the last battle was done? How many would be children? He had no room left in him for sorrow.
"Very generous," Nynaeve said in a tight voice. "But are we going to stand here all morning?"
The steam wagon was moving on out of sight quickly, yet her plump brown mare was still blowing anxiously and tossing her head, and she was having difficulty with the animal, placid as it was by nature. She was far from as good a rider as she thought herself. For that matter, Min's mount, an arch-necked gray mare from Algarin's stables, danced so that only Min's firm red-gloved grip on the reins kept her from running. And Olivia's roan was trying to dance, though the former Demani controlled the animal as easily as Cadswain did her bay. Olivia sometimes displayed surprising talents. Demani were expected to ride well. As they rode into the city, Rand took a last glance at the disappearing steam wagon. Remarkable was hardly the word. 100 wagons are only 50.
Only?
Incredible was more like it. Would merchants start using those things instead of horses? It hardly seemed likely. Merchants were conservative folk, not known for leaping at new ways of doing things. For some reason, Luce Theron began laughing again. Tyr was not beautiful, like Camelon or Tarvalen, and few of its streets could be called particularly broad. But it was large and sprawling, one of the great cities of the world, and, like most great cities, a jumble that had grown up willy-nilly. In those tangled streets, tile-roofed inns and slate-roofed stables, the roof corners slanted sharply, stood alongside palaces with squared white domes and tall balcony-ringed towers that often came to points, the heights of domes and towers gleaming in the early morning sun. Smithies and cutlers, seamstresses and butchers, fishmongers and rug-weavers' shops rubbed against marble structures with tall bronze doors behind massive white columns, guild halls and bankers' and merchants' exchanges. At this hour, the streets themselves were still cast in deep shadows, yet they bustled with that storied southern industry. Sedan chairs borne by pairs of lean men wove through the crowds almost as quickly as the children who raced about in play, while coaches and carriages behind teams of 4 or 6 moved as slowly as the carts and wagons, most drawn by large oxen. Porters trudged along, their bundles slung beneath poles carried on 2 men's shoulders, and apprentices carried rolled carpets and boxes of the master's handiwork on their backs. Hawkers cried their wares from trays or hand-barrows, pins and ribbons, a few with roasted nuts and meat pies, and tumblers or jugglers or musicians performed at nearly every intersection. You would never have thought this city was the site of a siege. Not everything was peaceful, though. Early morning or not, Rand saw obstreperous drunks being thrown out of inns and taverns, and so many fistfights and men wrestling on the pavement that it seemed one pair was not well out of sight before the next came into view. A good many obvious armsmen mingled in the crowd, swords at their hips and the fat sleeves of their woolen coats striped in various house colors, but even those wearing breastplates and helmets made no move to break up the rows. A fair number of the fights involved armsmen, with each other, with seafolk, with roughly clad fellows who might have been laborers or apprentices, or shoulder thumpers. Soldiers with nothing to do grew bored, and bored soldiers got drunk and fought. He was glad to see the rebels' armsmen bored. The maidens, drifting through the throng and still trying to pretend they had no association with Rand, drew puzzled looks and head-scratching, mainly from dark-faced seafolk, though a gaggle of children trailed after them gaping. The Tyrans, many of whom were not all that much fairer than the seafolk, had seen Aiel before, and if they wondered why they had returned to the city, it appeared they had different business at hand this morning, and more important. No one seemed to give Rand or his other companions a second glance. There were other mounted men and women in the streets, most of them outlanders, here a pale Kyrianan merchant in a somber coat, there an Arafelan with silver bells fastened to his dark braids, here a copper-skinned Domani, in a barely opaque riding dress, barely hidden by her cloak, followed by a pair of hulking bodyguards in leather coats sewn with steel discs, there a Shinaran with his head shaved except for a gray topknot, and his belly straining his buttons. You could not move 10 paces in Tyr without seeing outlanders. Tyran commerce had long arms. Which was not to say that he passed through the city without incident. Ahead of him, a running baker's boy tripped and fell, flinging his basket into the air, and when the boy levered himself off the paving stones as Rand rode by, he stopped halfway up with his mouth hanging open, staring at the long loaves, standing on end near the basket, propped together in a rough cone. A fellow in his shirt sleeves, drinking in a second-story window of an inn, overbalanced and toppled toward the street with a shriek that cut off when he landed on his feet not 10 paces from Tidashar, mug still in hand. Rand left him behind wide-eyed and feeling at himself in wonderment. Ripples of altered chance were following Rand through the city, spreading across the city. Not every event would be as harmless as the loaves or as beneficial as the man landing on his feet rather than his head. Those ripples could turn what should be a bruiseless tumble into broken bones or a broken neck. Lifelong feuds could be started by men speaking words they had never thought to hear come from their own lips. Women could decide to poison their husbands over trivial offenses they had tolerated complacently for years. Oh, some fellow might find a rotting sack full of gold buried in his own basement without really knowing why he had decided to dig in the first place. Or a man might ask and gain the hand of a woman he had never before had the courage to approach. But as many would find ruination as found good fortune. Balance, Min had called it. A good to balance every ill. He saw an ill to balance every good. He needed to be done in Tyr and gone as soon as possible. Galloping in those crowded streets was out of the question, but he picked up his pace enough that the maidens had to trot. His destination had been in sight since long before he entered the city, a mass of stone like a barren, sheer-sided hill that stretched from the river Arinon into the city's heart, covering at least 8 or 9 marches, a good square mile or more, and dominating the city's sky. The Stone of Tyr was mankind's oldest stronghold, the oldest structure in the world, made with the one power in the last days of the breaking itself. One solid piece of stone it was, without a single join, though better than 3,000 years of rain and wind had weathered the surface to roughness. The first battlements stood 100 paces above the ground, though there were arrow slits aplenty lower, and stone spouts for showering attackers with boiling oil or molten lead. No besieger could stop the stone from being supplied through its own wall-shielded docks, and it contained forges and manufactories to replace or mend every sort of weapon should its armories fall short. Its highest tower, rearing over the very center of the stone, held the banner of Tyr, half red, half gold, with a slanting line of three silver crescents, and so large that it could be made out plainly as it curled in a strong breeze. It had to be strong to move that flag. Lower towers supported smaller versions, but here they alternated with another rippling banner, the ancient symbol of Aes Sedai, black and white on a field of red. The Banner of Light, the Dragon Banner, some called it, as if there were not another that bore that name. The High Lord Darlan was flaunting his allegiance, it seemed. That was well. Alana was in there, and whether or not that was well, he would have to learn. He was not as sharply aware of her as before Elaine and Avienda and Min jointly bonded him. He thought he was not. They had pushed her aside to take primacy somehow, and she had told him she could sense little more of him than his presence. Yet she still lay in the back of his head, a bundle of emotions and physical sensations. It seemed a long time since he had been near enough to her to sense those. Once again the bond with her felt an intrusion, a would-be usurper of his bond to Min and Elaine and Avienda. Alana was weary, as if perhaps she had not been getting enough sleep lately, and frustrated, with strong streaks of anger and sulkiness. Were the negotiations going badly? He would find out soon enough. She would be aware he was in the city, aware he was coming closer, if little more. Min had tried to teach him a trick called masking that supposedly could hide him from the bond, but he had never been able to make it work. Of course, she admitted she had never been able to make it work either. Soon he found himself on a street that ran directly to the plaza that surrounded the stone on three sides, but he had no intention of riding straight there. For one thing, every massive iron-strapped gate would be barred tight. For another, he could see several hundred armsmen at the foot of the street. He expected there would be the same in front of every gate. They hardly gave the impression of men besieging a fortress. They seemed to be lounging about with no order. Many had their helmets off, and their halberds propped against the buildings lining the street, and serving women from nearby taverns and inns circulated among them selling mugs of ale or wine from trays. Yet it was highly unlikely they would remain complacent about anyone trying to enter the stone. Not that they could stop him, of course. He could sweep aside a few hundred men like so many moths. He had not come to Tyr to kill anyone, though, not unless he had to, so he rode into the stable-yard of a tile-roofed inn, three stories of dark gray stone with a prosperous look. The sign out front was freshly painted with, of all things, a rough approximation of the creatures encircling his forearms. The artist apparently had decided the thing was inadequate as described, though, because he had added long, sharp teeth and leathery, ribbed wings. Wings! They almost looked copied from one of those Shonchan flying beasts. Cadswain looked at the sign and snorted. Nynaeve looked at it and giggled. So did Min. Even after Rand gave the barefoot stable boys silver to curry the horses, they stared at the maidens harder than at the coins, but no harder than the patrons stared in the dragon's beam-ceiling common room. Conversation trailed off when the maidens followed Rand and the others inside, spear points sticking up above their heads and bullhide bucklers in hand. Men and women, most in plain, if good quality, wool, turned in their low-backed chairs to stare. They seemed to be middling merchants and solid craftsfolk, yet they gaped like villagers seeing a city for the first time. The serving women, in dark high-necked dresses and short white aprons, stopped trotting and goggled over their trays. Even the woman playing a hammered dulcimer between the two stone fireplaces, cold on this fine morning, fell silent. A very dark fellow with tightly curled hair, at a square table beside the door, seemed not to notice the maidens at all. Rand took him for one of the sea folk at first, though he wore a peculiar coat without collar or lapels, once white but now stained and wrinkled.
"I tell you, I have many, many of the worms that make... yes, make silk on a ship,"
he said haltingly in an odd musical accent. "But I must have and berry, yes, and berry leaves to feed them. We will be rich." His companion waved a plump, dismissive hand even while staring at the maidens. "Worms," he said absently. "Everybody knows silk grows on trees." Walking deeper into the common room, Rand shook his head as the proprietor advanced to meet him. Worms. The tales people could come up with to try prying coin out of somebody.
"A garde s'arrange at your service, my lord, my ladies," the lean, balding man said with a deep bow, sweeping his hands wide.
Not all Tyrans were dark by any means, but he was nearly as fair-complected as a Kyrianan.
"How may I serve?"
His dark eyes kept drifting to the maidens, and every time they did, he tugged at his long blue coat as though it suddenly felt too tight.
"We want a room with a good view of the stone," Rand said.
"It is worms that make silk, friend," a man drawled behind him. "My eyes on it."
At that familiar accent, Rand spun to find Olivia staring, wide-eyed and her face bloodless, at a man in a dark coat who was just passing through the doorway into the street. With an oath, Rand ran to the door, but there were close to a dozen men in dark coats walking away from the inn, any one of whom might have spoken. There was no way to pick out one man of average height and width, seen only from behind. What was a Seanchan doing in Tyr? Scouting for another invasion? He would put paid to that soon enough. But he turned from the door, wishing he could have laid hands on the man. Knowing would be better than having to guess. He asked Olivia whether she had gotten a good look at the fellow, but she shook her head silently. Her face was still pale. She was ferocious when she talked of what she wanted to do to Suldam, yet it seemed just hearing the accents of her native land was enough to shake her. He hoped that did not turn out to be weakness in her. She was going to help him somehow, and he could not afford her to be weak. "What do you know of this man who just left?" he demanded of Saranche. "The one with the slurred way of talking." The innkeeper blinked.
"Nothing, my lord. I've never seen him before." "You want one room, my lord?"
He ran his eyes over Min and the other women, and his lips moved as if he were counting.
"If you're thinking of any impropriety, Master Saranche," Nynaeve said indignantly, tugging at the braid hanging from the cowl of her cloak, "you had best think twice and again, before I box your ears."
Min hissed softly, and one hand drifted toward her other wrist before she checked the motion. Light, but she was quick to reach for her knives.
"What impropriety?" Olivia asked in tones of puzzlement.
Cadswain snorted.
"One room," Rand said patiently. Women can always find a reason to be indignant, he thought. Or had that been Luce Theron?
He shrugged in discomfort, and a touch of irritation that he only just managed to keep out of his voice.
"Your largest with a view of the stone. We don't want it for long. You'll be able to rent it out again for tonight. You may have to keep our horses a day or two, though."
A look of relief crept over Saranche's narrow face, though patently false rue filled his voice.
"I regret that my largest room is taken, my lord. In fact, all of my large rooms are taken. But I will be more than happy to escort you up the street to the Three Moons and—"
"Pfah!"
Cadswain pushed back her hood enough to reveal her face and some of her golden hair ornaments. She was all cool composure, her gaze implacable.
"I think you can find a way to make that room available, boy. I think you had better find a way. Pay him well," she added to Rand, ornaments swaying on their chains. "That was advice, not an order."
Saranche took Rand's fat golden crown with alacrity. It was doubtful the entire inn earned much more in a week. But it was Cadswain's ageless face that sent him bounding up the staircase at the back of the common room to return in a handful of minutes and show them to a room on the second floor with dark polished paneling and a rumpled bed wide enough for three, flanked by a pair of windows filled by the stone looming over the rooftops. The previous occupant had been hustled out so quickly that he had left a woolen stocking crumpled at the foot of the bed and a carved horn comb on the washstand in the corner. The innkeeper offered to have their saddlebags brought up, and wine, and seemed surprised when Rand refused, but one glance at Cadswain's face, and he bowed his way out again hurriedly. The room was fairly large as in-rooms went, yet not compared to most chambers in Algarin's manor house, much less in a palace, especially not with near a dozen people filling the space. The walls seemed to close in on Rand. His chest suddenly felt tight. Every breath came with difficulty. The bond was suddenly full of sympathy and concern.
"The box," Luce Theron panted. "Have to get out of the box."
Keeping his eyes on the windows, being able to see the stone was a necessity, and seeing open air between the dragon and the stone, the open air above loosened his breathing a little. Just a little. Keeping his eyes fixed on the sky above the stone, he ordered everyone to stand against the walls. They obeyed with speed. Well, Cadswain gave him a sharp look before gliding to the wall, and Nynaeve sniffed before flouncing over, but the rest moved quickly. If they thought he wanted space for safety's sake, in a way he did. Having them out of his line of sight made the room seem a little larger. Only a little, yet every inch was a blessed relief. The bond was filled with concern.
"Must get out," Luce Theron moaned. "Have to get out."
Stiffening himself against what he knew would come, watchful of any attempt by Luce Theron, Rand seized the male half of the true source and Saidine flowed into him. Had the madman tried to seize it first? He had brushed it, certainly, touched it, but it was Rand's. Mountains of flame collapsing in fiery avalanches tried to scour him away. Waves that made ice seem warm tried to crush him in raging seas. He gloried in it, suddenly so alive it seemed he had been sleepwalking before. He could hear the breath of everyone in the room, could see that great banner atop the stone so clearly he almost thought he could make out the weave of the fabric. The double wound in his side throbbed as if trying to rip itself out of his body. But with the power filling him, he could ignore that pain. He thought he could have ignored a sword thrust. Yet with Saidine came the inevitable violent nausea, the almost overwhelming desire to double over and empty himself of every meal he had ever eaten. His knees trembled with it. He fought that as hard as he fought the power, and Saidine had to be fought ever and always. A man forced Saidine to his will, or it destroyed him. The face of the man from Shadar Logoth floated in his head for a moment. He looked furious, and near to sicking up. Without any doubt, he was aware of Rand in that moment, and Rand of him. Move a hair in any direction, and they would touch. No more than a hair.
"What's the matter?"
Nynaeve demanded, moving close and peering up at him in concern.
"Your face has gone all gray."
She reached for his head, and his skin popped out in goosebumps. He brushed her hands away.
"I'm all right. Stand clear."
She stood there, giving him one of those looks women carried in their belt pouches. This one said she knew he was lying, even if she could not prove it. Did they practice those looks in front of mirrors?
"Stand clear, Nynaeve."
"He's all right, Nynaeve,"
Min said, though her face had a touch of gray about it too, and she had both red-gloved hands pressed to her middle. She knew. Nynaeve sniffed at him, wrinkling her nose in disdain, but she finally moved out of his way. Maybe Lan had had enough and run away. No, not that. Lan would not leave her unless she told him to, and then only for as long as was needful. Wherever he was, Nynaeve knew, and likely had sent him there for reasons of her own. Aes Sedai and their bloody secrets. He channeled, spirit touched with fire, and the familiar vertical silvery slash appeared at the foot of the bed, seemed to rotate into a dim view of massive columns in darkness. Light from the in-room gave all the illumination. The opening, standing inches above the floor, was no larger than the door to the room, yet as soon as it was fully open, three of the maidens, already veiled, darted through, pulling spears free, and Rand's skin pebbled again as Olivia leaped after them. Protecting him was a self-imposed duty, but one she took as seriously as the maidens did. There would be no ambush here, though, no dangers, so he stepped through and down. At the other end, the gateway sat more than a foot above the huge gray slabs of stone that he had not wanted to damage any more than he already had. This was the heart of the stone, and with the power in him, and the light spilling from the gateway from the room in the dragon, he could see the narrow hole in one of those stones where he had driven Kalendor into the floor. Who draws it out shall follow after. He had thought long and hard before sending Narishma to bring Kalendor to him. However, the prophecies meant the man was to follow. Narishma was otherwise occupied today. A forest of immense redstone columns surrounded him, stretching up into the dark that hid the unlit golden lamps and the vaulted ceiling and the great dome. His boots echoed hollowly in the vast chamber, and even the whispers of the maiden's soft boots. In this space, the sense of confinement vanished. Min hopped down right behind him, with a throwing knife in either hand, and her head swiveling, eyes searching the darkness, but Cadswain, standing at the edge of the gateway, said, "I don't jump unless I absolutely have to, boy." She held out a hand, waiting for him to take it. He handed her down, and she nodded thanks. It could have been meant for thanks. It could have meant you took your bloody time about it, too. A ball of light appeared over her upturned palm, and a moment later Olivia was balancing a globe of light, too. The pair created a pool of brightness that turned the surrounding darkness deeper. Nynaeve required the same courtesy, and had the grace to murmur thanks. She quickly gained her own ball of light. But when he offered a hand to one of the maidens, he thought it was Sarendra, one of the Shido, though all he could see of her face was blue eyes above her black veil. She grunted contemptuously and leaped down, spear in hand, followed by the other two. He let the gateway close, but held on to Sayadin despite the roiling in his stomach and head. He did not expect to need to channel again before he left the stone, yet he did not want to give Luz Theron another opportunity to seize the power either.
"You have to trust me," Luz Theron snarled. "If we're going to make it to Tarmon Gaiden so we can die, you have to trust me."
"You told me once not to trust anyone," Rand thought, "including you." "Only madmen trust no one," Luz Theron whispered. Abruptly, he began to weep.
"Oh, why do I have a madman in my head?"
Rand pushed the voice away. On striding through the tall arch that led from the heart, he was surprised to find two defenders of the stone in ridged helmets and shining breastplates, the puffy sleeves of their black coats striped in black and gold. Swords drawn, they were staring at the archway with expressions that combined confusion with grim resolution. Doubtless, they had been startled to see lights and hear footsteps echoing in a room with only one entrance, an entrance they were guarding. The maidens crouched, spears coming up, spreading out to either side, slowly curling in toward the pair.
"By the stone, it's him,"
one of the men said, sheathing his sword hurriedly. Stocky, with a puckered scar that began on his forehead and journeyed across the bridge of his nose and down to his jaw, he bowed deeply, hands in steel-backed gauntlets spreading wide.
"My lord dragon," he said. "Jagenhander, my lord. The stone stands. I got this that day."
He touched the scar on his face. "An honorable wound, Handar, and a day to remember," Rand told him as the other, leaner man hastily put up his blade and bowed. Only then did the maidens lower their spears, but their faces remained veiled. A day to remember? Trollocs and Murdral inside the stone. The second time he had truly wielded Kalendor, using the sword that was not a sword as it was meant to be used. The dead lying everywhere, a dead girl he could not make live again. Who could forget such a day? "I know I gave orders for the heart to be guarded while Kalendor was there, but why are you still standing guard?" The two men exchanged puzzled looks.
"You gave the order to set guards, my lord dragon," Handar said, "and the defenders obey.
But you never said anything about Kalimdor except that no one was to approach it unless they had proof they came from you.
Suddenly the stocky man gave a start and bowed again, more deeply still.
Forgive me, my lord, if I seem to question you. I don't mean to. Shall I summon the High Lords to your apartments? Your rooms have been kept in readiness for your return.
No need, Rand told him. Darlin will be expecting me, and I know where to find him. Hendar winced. The other man suddenly found something interesting on the floor to study.
You may require a guide, my lord, Hendar said slowly. The corridors. Sometimes the corridors change.
So, the pattern truly was loosening. That meant the Dark One was touching the world more than he had since the War of the Shadow. If it loosened too much before Tarmangaiden, the Age Lace might unravel. An end to time and reality and creation. Somehow he had to bring about the last battle before that happened. Only he did not dare. Not yet. He assured Hendar and the other man that he needed no guide, and the pair of them bowed yet again, apparently accepting the Dragon Reborn could do anything he said he could do. In simple truth, he knew he could locate Alana. He could have pointed straight at her. And she had moved since he first felt her. To find Darlin and inform him that Randall Thor was approaching, he was sure. Min had named her as one he held in his hand, yet Aes Sedai always found a way to play both ends against the middle. They always had schemes of their own, goals of their own. Witness Nynaeve and Varen. Witness any of them.
They hop when you say toad, Cadswain said coolly, pushing the cowl of her cloak down her back, as they walked away from the heart. That can be bad for you, when too many people jump at your word.
She had the nerve to say that. Cadswain Bloody Maladrin?
I'm fighting a war, he told her harshly. The nausea had his temper on edge. That was part of the reason he was harsh. The fewer people who obey, the more chance I'll lose, and if I lose, everybody loses. If I could make everybody obey, I would.
There were far too many who did not obey as it was, or obeyed in their own way. Why in the light would Min feel pity? Cadswain nodded.
As I thought, she murmured half to herself.
And what was that supposed to mean?